We are going to talk about hot cars and how to most effectively stay cool in the car, the most cost-effective ways to stay cool in the car during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, financial planner Kevin McKinley will raise some concerns about longevity insurance. We'll have some tips on finding fresh fruits and vegetables. Will tell us about an upcoming financial literacy event and answers to your personal finance questions. What money matter is on your mind today? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Oh, wait, I was still kind of salsing around the studio here after
hot, hot,
the
hot.
Intro music. Right. Hello, Joy.
Well, it is, it's not so hot today, but August is prime time for driving around town and around the country. And we are going to settle the age-old debate on the most cost-effective way to keep cool while you're in the car. What's the story, Kevin?
This was such a great topic to research because when you go online and you're looking for different stories on the subject, one of the ways to tell how passionate people feel about a particular subject is the amount of comments underneath the story. And I found several stories about this topic that had several hundred comments underneath. So if if the political rancor in Wisconsin ever dies down a little bit, I have a new topic that newspaper sites can use to inspire a bunch of comments. And it is whether you should run the air conditioning or not. There is a philosophical debate about fresh air versus recycled air, but then the facts come back to the fuel efficiency. There's tons of studies done on the subject, and even a Mythbusters episode from a few years ago attempted to quell all the controversy and to see if they could come up with an answer as to which was better.
Well, what is the consensus?
The consensus is in town, roll the windows down, lower speeds, and stop-and-go traffic, generally below 45 miles per hour. It's probably better to aerate the car with the windows open. And by the way, if you are driving around town with your windows open, turn your radio down just as a courtesy to the other drivers. Unless you are listening to On Your Money on Wisconsin Public Radio, then
blast
crank it up and rip the knobs off. But if you're on the highway and you're going over 45 to 50 miles per hour, air conditioning is better. There's usually a 10% drop in fuel efficiency in a vehicle with the air conditioning on. But at highway speeds, there's a 20% drop in fuel efficiency. And it's more so true if you have a more fuel-efficient vehicle, like if you have a sedan or hatchback versus an SUV. But there are still several other non-fuel efficiency reasons to actually turn the air conditioning on.
What are those reasons?
If you're on the highway, open windows can be dangerous to you. There was a study from the Taipei Medical University School that found that similar groups of people who drove for 2 hours on the freeway, with one with air conditioning on and the windows rolled up and one with the windows down, the people with the air conditioning on had a 32% better heart condition in terms of their efficiency of their heart. They said it was possibly because of the filters were blocking out exhaust particles and pollutants and disrupting the heart's electrical signals. It's also a hearing issue. On the interstate with the windows down, the sound level can exceed 85 decibels. That's in the danger zone, and it's similar to what you might get at a rock concert or by running a table saw. And, of course, the air quality is filtered, so you do get a better quality running through your air conditioner rather than with the windows open. But there is a compromise. If you are with a passenger and one wants the windows down and the other says, no, I want the windows up and the air conditioned, there's a way to avoid any more controversy.
We would just do what I want to do.
Yeah, exactly. If you're driving, it's your car, right?
Well, what is the compromise, though?
Leave the windows up, but turn the vents on. You'll still get some fresh in there. It still will be filtered to some extent, but there's no taxation to the engine. Still get the good fuel efficiency, and you get a little breeze that will help cool you down.
So any other air conditioning tips for travelers?
Yeah, you want to get it checked now. Set an appointment. If you're going to be on the road, especially if you're driving someplace even warmer than Wisconsin right now, you want to get that air conditioner checked. Take the car in for a tune-up and get everything checked out, the coolant, the compressor, the filters changed, etc. And make sure that any problems are fixed now in advance, because it can make a bad trip even worse without air conditioning.
Good. I didn't know a lot of that. But you know what else? I still don't quite know. I don't know if I'm supposed to use fresh or recycled in terms of, I just keep the knob where it was when I bought it. Is there, do you have a preference on that, Kevin?
You could do that. Just take it into the dealership and ask them to turn the knob for you, too. I think they'll
do that. They'll probably do that. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, call us now. We have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag segment. A listener named Harry writes, Mr. McKinley. Wow, so formal. First of all, thank you for your regular contributions to the Tuesday show. I'm usually one of your listeners. Okay, enough flattery. Could you please recommend places to find a fee-only advisor? The kind that doesn't sell products out of his wagon or on a commission. Better yet, the type that charges by the hour instead of a percentage of assets under management. This would be for my son, who lives in Rhode Island and will be soon committing matrimony. Thanks in advance, Mr. McKinley.
Wow. Not only did he properly and formally address me by Mr. McKinley, but he submitted false praise and did the very clever little known move of thanking in advance, which completely obligates us to answer this question.
Yes.
It's one we get fairly frequently. There are three different sites you can go to find fee-only advisors. Start with the Certified Financial Planner site, then NAPFA, N-A-P-F-A, and FPA Net. I think the certified financial one is letsmakeaplan.org. And then there's the Garrett Financial Planning Network, which is a small network of fee-based financial planners, mostly around the Midwest. I don't know how many we have here in Wisconsin, but we'll put websites up that will give you those links at onyourmoney.com later on today. And so you can search for people in Rhode Island. You do probably have to find someone in Rhode Island, because many times the states in which a planner can serve, they have to be registered in certain states. And so sometimes a planner in, say, Wisconsin might not be able to serve someone in Rhode Island.
Okay. Well, what kind of questions should one ask a prospective financial advisor?
I would ask them how you get paid and how much you get paid from a particular investment or relationship. Do you have a specialty? And if so, is it the specialty that that serves me best? What kind of services do you provide? What kind of contact schedule will we have? Is it once a year? Is it every quarter? Is it whenever need be? Are you a fiduciary? A fiduciary means that the advisor is technically obligated to give advice that is best for the client, even if it costs the advisor money. And not all fiduciaries are great advisors, and not all great advisors are fiduciaries, but there is a Venn diagram where the better advisor relationship is usually served by being a fiduciary. And then finally, in terms of contact, who am I going to be speaking with? Is it going to be you, or is it going to be an assistant, or do you have different specialists within the firm that serve me in different capacities?
So what is a typical cost to work with a fee-based advisor?
They're going by the hour. They typically charge, like attorneys do, you're about $150 to $300 an hour, depending on the services offered. And if you're going to go in for kind of a one-shot consultation, you can expect to spend usually $1,000 to $2,000 from start to finish. It's definitely okay to ask those questions in advance so that you know what you're getting into before you get into it. For the ongoing relationship that Harry is trying to avoid for his son, people WINO usually charge anywhere from 0.5% of the assets under management per year up to 2%. So if they have, say, $500,000, they might charge typically around 1% for that. And that should be all-inclusive generally. There generally is no extra cost on top of that for other types of services. And hopefully the advisor only gets paid by the client and not any extra commissions above and beyond that fee.
So thank you, Harry, and good luck. Congratulations to your son committing matrimony. We also received an email from a listener endorsing an upcoming financial literacy event. What's this all about, Kevin?
Yeah, Maggie sent in an email endorsing a money conference that she's gone to. And we talk a lot about financial literacy. I'm actually familiar with the group sponsoring this. It is a great conference. It's the 14th annual Madison Money Conference. Very small donation or dollars to get in, $3 in advance for adults, $5 at the door, 8:30 a.m. on Friday, August 16th, and it's at Wright Middle School in Fish Hatchery Road. And there are actually other events that this organization, AssetBuilders.org, puts around the state in Racine and Appleton, et cetera. But it's basically where you can go and get information on all different kinds of financial topics, whether it's retirement or dealing with debt or saving for college or estate planning. And Asset Builders arranges to have different specialists set up and usually in different classrooms around in a school setting for. Richard Entman has done this for a long time and does a really great job with it. I spoke a couple times at the one up in the Fox Valley over the past few years. But go to assetbuilders.org if you want to find out more about these money conferences, either the one in Madison or one coming to your area.
And we did receive a Facebook post, Kevin, from a listener who says, where can I find the links, all the helpful links that Kevin mentions on Your Money?
We usually put them up after each show at onyourmoney.com. They usually go up a day or two afterwards, but we're working on a resource page so that all these links that we discuss are going to be on one page. We hope to have that done this month, maybe.
Ooh, all right. We'll look forward to that. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with us most every Tuesday at this time, answering your personal finance questions. If you have one for Kevin, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org, onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up in the show, we will we'll talk about a little known source of income called longevity insurance, and we'll go shopping around for the best deals on fresh fruits and vegetables. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey,
hey. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, who is here providing information and advice on your money. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's take our first caller, Marie in Janesville. Hello, Marie.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm turning 70 and a half this month, and I understand, I'm still working. And I understand that I could possibly delay taking my allotment from those IRAs until the beginning of next year when I will be retired.
You can delay it, but it's not because you're necessarily because you're working. It's because the first required minimum, you're talking about required minimum distributions,
yes,
right, Marie?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yep.
And I just want, my income will be greatly reduced next year compared to this year.
Sure. The ruling is that you have to take your first distribution by April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half. And the reason they set it up that way is a lot of people were forgetting to take it at 70 and a half. And there's a pretty big penalty if you don't take it out. They say that, okay, well, we'll give people an extra 3 months. But the problem with that is that's technically 2014's distribution. You still have to take 2015's distribution in calendar year 2015 and every year thereafter. However, as you've correctly surmised, Marie, it's smarter to do two distributions in one calendar year or one tax year, rather than take one this year and then one next year if you are going to be in a higher tax bracket and have more income in 2014. So based on what you told me, Marie, I think you're exactly right. You should actually take two distributions next year when your income is lower, and you probably need the money more as well next year too.
Yes, I will. Now, I don't need to do anything except notify my where my IRAs are that I'm going to do that, correct?
Yep. They'll probably, if they're on the ball, they'll contact you later this year and say, hey, lady, you turned 70 and a half, take some money out, and you just say, hey, I'm not going to take it out. I'm aware of that, but I'm going to do it by April 1st of 2015, and then expect to do another one by December 31st of 2015 and every year after.
Okay. That's exactly what I was hoping you'd say. Thank you.
Kevin aims to please.
I aim to please. That's right. I read that philosophy on a wall above a urinal one time, yeah. And I followed it as much as possible.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and we have an open line for you if you have a question for Kevin. Our lines were full, and then everybody gave up, or they're just calling in to call you names, Kevin, or something. I'm not sure.
It was probably the urinal comment. I was disgusted and said goodbye.
1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org, onyourmoney@wpr.org. We do have an email from Joseph. My company has sold my division to a private equity firm, and a new company will be formed. With this process, I have three options for my 401k. With the existing company, leave it where it is, roll it over into the new changes plan, or roll it over into an IRA. Which do you think is the best option, Kevin?
Based on this scant information, I would say leave it with the existing plan. And the reason being is that he can probably always roll it over into the new 401k, and he'll eventually want to roll it into an IRA. Unless the investment options are very expensive or very limited, leaving it in the 401k is usually a better thing to do. The only time I would say that it might be a good idea to take it out and move it to an IRA is if he doesn't think he's going to need to borrow from it, because if you have a 401k, you can usually get a loan from it. That can be very advantageous. And if he wants something that's safer and completely under his control. Now, a lot of people get worried when companies change hands about what's going to happen with their 401k. And the options can change and the matching can change, for better or for worse. But it's still your money. The company technically can't do anything with it when they're sold. They can try sometimes, and smaller employers sometimes get in the news because they don't make the contributions they were supposed to make. But that's very rare, and it's typically better to leave it in the 401k if you're very comfortable with the investment options.
We had another email. What's going on here? Lots of emails. Chris in Minneapolis emails, my new employer does not offer a 401k or any retirement investment vehicles. So how do I start investing?
This is very common, and it's more common actually when people change jobs and they have to work at a certain place for a period of time before they become eligible for the at-work retirement savings plan. It's one of the reasons people who do change jobs have a harder time saving money for retirement, because they're not eligible for the at-work plan. But Chris can actually contribute to an IRA and save from anywhere from $5,500, $6,500 if he's over 50. And if he's married, he can make a spousal contribution as well. So he, in theory, could save anywhere from $11,000 to $13,000 for a married couple into a retirement plan. And if he's in a high tax bracket and he can afford to tuck the money aside for a while, he should use a regular IRA. And if he's going to need that money, though, is in a lower tax bracket, he's probably better off with a Roth IRA. He won't get a tax deduction, but he can pull the money out whenever he wants, at any time, for any reason, with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. That's the contribution portion. And he does not have to make the contributions to the IRA or Roth IRA until April 15th of next year for the 2014 tax year. However, he can set it up so that it's kind of like a deduction to a 401k, where it's not pulled out of his paycheck, but it's pulled out of his savings account. Say $250 every month or something can go directly from his checking or savings account into the IRA or Roth IRA.
Let's go to the phones. Tom in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Tom. What's your question?
I got to turn my phone off here. I got to turn my radio off. Anyhow, yeah, I was calling. I have questions on annuities. I had a 7-year annuity, which was up last year. And now my advisor from the bank is saying that he can get a 7% annuity for the next 7 years. I'm 60 years old, and I just was wondering what you thought about annuities versus I was thinking about possibly doing a little bit of the annuity and then going to like somebody like Edward D. Jones for maybe a little bit more growth. Some people told me that the 7%, I'm throttling myself, that that's all I'll ever make on it. I was wondering if you could respond to that.
Well, there's good and bad news. I wish you were throttling yourself with a 7% guaranteed rate of return, Tom, but that's not what that actually is. And when you said that the annuity's gone through 7 years, was it a fixed annuity or was it a variable annuity?
Variable.
Okay. This happens way too often. Someone has an annuity with a particular provider, and the 7 years or something is up, as Tom mentions. And it really has nothing to do with your situation, Tom. You can keep the annuity you have. The problem is that the people selling you the annuity want to make another commission. So they're trying to roll you over into another annuity because, so they can then get paid. And you will then likely incur a new 7 or 8 or 10 year surrender charge so that the insurance company can make back the commissions that they're paying to this person trying to sell you this new annuity. Now, this new annuity might be a little better. It might not be. But I can guarantee you will pay a lot more for it if you try to pull it out between now and the next, say, 7 to 10 years. And so I'd be very cautious of moving it into this next annuity unless there was some substantial reason to do so. Otherwise, you can likely leave that money in your current annuity and pull it out whenever you want in the future without incurring any surrender charge at all. The second thing is the 7% is a very common misconception. It's usually because the salesperson has not made it very clear as to how this 7% works. You will not make 7% per year on this. As a matter of fact, fixed annuities that pay a fixed interest rate usually pay now closer to 2 or 3% a year if you're lucky, and that's for a very long lockup period. What they mean by that 7% is they have an annuitization base, where they mean that your base on which you can annuitize the money will grow by 7% a year under certain circumstances. And again, you're going to pay a lot of fees to have to go into this, and you might never need or want to annuitize that money. So I would be very cautious of that 7%. It sounds like the person selling it to you has, for better or for worse, has not done a very good job of explaining how that actually works. And it's a very common misconception. And it's not your fault. It's the fault of the salesperson. A lot of times I used to think that when I'd hear these stories, Tom, that the salespeople were actually misleading you on purpose. The more often I dove into this, I'd find that the salesperson doesn't understand it either, and they very likely haven't read the 280-page prospectus that they gave to you, and you haven't read either. And so I'd be very cautious about moving it into a new annuity. Depending on your risk and tolerance and what kind of growth you want, you might be better off moving it into like a low-cost mutual fund at a place like Vanguard if you could.
Okay, Tom?
Yes, thank you. What do you think about going to somebody for, like Edward D. Jones for financial advice?
I would shop around. I would look for another financial advisor and see what they have to say. Usually they'll give you a lot of information and advice without having to commit to something. They should anyway. And you might find a different person or a different perspective that suits you a little better.
Thanks to Tom in Green Bay, number one. Now we go to Tom in Green Bay, number two. Hello, Tom, number two.
Okay, now I get it. The coincidence was incredible.
Yes.
We do very well in that narrow demographic of Tom's in Green Bay's. Huge.
At the same exact time. I'll be whoever you say I'll be. And my question is regarding mature savings bonds. We've got a modest amount, and we don't need them right now, but we're trying to, we just learned some things about that you now have to actually send them in to cash them instead of taking them to the bank. And we're trying to decide what's best to do with them for tax purposes. Should we wait till we retire and just do them then?
Technically, the law says that you really do have to, you have to cash them in and you have to pay taxes, because these are probably bonds that have built up interest and then you've never paid the taxes on the interest, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Is it a, are we talking more than $10,000 or $20,000 in value here?
No, $12,000, right?
Okay.
Current value. It was just run, and they're all 4% interest rate.
Okay, but the 4% is expiring. You can't get that anymore, right?
I think it keeps going, doesn't it?
Okay. If it, it, they're usually 30-year bonds. If you can still get 4%, I would do absolutely nothing with them unless you're in some kind of financial emergency.
No, there's a final maturity date on all of these things. That's off in the future, in the 2020 range.
Okay, yeah. Then definitely don't cash those things in. Those are like gold right now.
Okay.
The normal rate, Tom, if you had new money that you were putting in those savings bonds, either Series I or Series E, is closer to 1% than 4%. So unless you need the money, let them keep running. And especially if you are retiring soon, you'll probably be in a lower tax bracket. And so when you cash them in, you'll pay less in taxes on them.
Yeah, that's a given. We're going to be in a lower tax bracket. Okay. That's the advice I needed. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Tom, for the call. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Time now for Smart Assets. Retirees might have a new reason to purchase a little-known source of income. What is this little-known source of income, Kevin?
It's about to become bigger known. It's called longevity insurance. And what it is it's a delayed immediate annuity. You give a lump sum over to an insurance company now, and they promise at some point off into the future to pay you back a certain dollar amount every single month over a certain period of time. So let's say if you're 60, you might have $50,000, and you might give it to the insurance company in the form of a longevity insurance purchase. And they'll say, okay, when you're 70, then you can start getting, let's say, $350 a month for your life.
So why is it that more people are going to be interested in longevity insurance?
There was a new ruling that is going to allow people who purchase these within IRAs or 401k accounts to not have a portion of that money included into the amount that's that is used to calculate the required minimum distribution. So they won't have to take RMDs on these dollar amounts. And it's the lesser of 25% of the account balance or $125,000. So technically, once you buy one of these, you lower the amount on which you have to pull your required minimum distribution each year. You're still going to pull this money out at some point, and you will pay taxes on it, but at least it's not going to be figured into the RMD equation anymore.
Are you a fan of longevity insurance?
I love the philosophy. I think it's a great thing for people to think, well, what happens if I outlive my money, or I live longer than I expect, and I still need money to survive? The problem, of course, is in the details. When you hand money over to an insurance company, or anybody for that matter, it's not just the insurance companies, you are making a bet, and you are placing your faith in the insurance company that not only will they be around to honor their obligation, but they will do a good enough job of managing your money to get the return that they need so that they can pay all of their expenses and their profits and the shareholders, etc., but also give you the money that you have coming to you too. And there sometimes is a conflict of interest in the insurance companies because they're trying to make as much money as possible to cover all those expenses, etc. But they're taking, if to do that, they have to take more risks. And when they take more risks, they have a better chance of losing the money. So I don't like that. No, I don't like immediate annuities a lot anyway right now, especially because the interest rates are so low. But I especially don't like the idea of giving money to the insurance company in a lump sum for something that's going to be long off in the future if it ever occurs.
So what might we do instead?
When it comes to annuitizing money, I'd almost rather have people bury their whole money in the hole in the ground and just pull it out month by month. And if you go to a website like immediateannuities.com and make the calculations, you'll find that it's actually not a whole lot less just to give yourself your principal back every single month than it is to give it to the insurance company. It's because interest rates on safe money is so low, the insurance company can't make very much on it investing safely. If you want to earn a little bit of rate of return, you might want to look at laddered certificates of deposit that come due every single year, and then just plan on spending it, that money every single year. For instance, you might say, well, I have $100,000, and rather than buying the median annuity, I'm going to buy 20 CDs that mature in $5,000 increments every single year. And then if I need that $5,000, I can spend it, but if not, I can reinvest it, and under certain penalties, I can still get access to that money if I need it in the future. You can also look at long-term bonds, or, as we mentioned with one of the many Toms from Green Bay who have called in today, those Series I savings bonds, laddering those up as well can be a great way to get a safer but still similar rate of return as to what you would get on one of these kinds of annuities.
We have a call coming in from a Tom in New Holsting in just a moment. And maybe your call too, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me you better shop around.
Time now to shop around. A combination of factors means that now is a good time to get your produce from somewhere other than the supermarket. What do you mean by that, Kevin?
I think it's one of the things that's keeping a lid on our spending in the supermarket is we all start in the produce section, and there is a sticker shock there. I like my fresh fruit and vegetables as much as anybody. But when you go in there, you go, wait a minute, $4.79 for 7 apples or something like that. You can't believe what prices have done. And there's a reason for that. It's not the supermarket getting rich. It's because of higher demand and drought conditions in California. And year over year, fruit prices have jumped about 6% or so, according to the government, and about 2% for vegetables. But different items have really soared in price. Tomatoes are up about 20%. Corn is up about 15%. Lettuce is up 30 or 40% or so. So right now, it's possible to get the same or better quality for the same or less money if you're willing to shop a little bit differently.
Yeah, so where should I go shopping for this stuff?
Start locally at the farmers market. Wisconsin ranked 8th in for farmers markets in the country for states. And you definitely want to get there early if you want to get the best selection. Bring singles if you want to be kind to your farmer's market vendor, because they do not have a ton of singles there and they usually use them up during the day. And finally, go late, and as they're cleaning up, say, hey, is there anything you would just as soon sell me at a lower price rather than take home? And it's fair to ask. They can say, no, there's nothing I want. You can also ask the farmer's market vendor to say, is there something that's particularly good right now that you're really proud of? It came in a good bumper crop, and you've got it at a good price. And make sure you get in and out of there in a hurry. But check out farmer's market locations at nmfd.org, nmfd.org.
Yeah, I know that sometimes at the Dane County Farmers Market, if you're there at the end, once in a while, a vendor will be, 2 for 1 for the cantaloupe or whatever.
They don't want to take it home and throw it away. They'd rather make a little bit of money off of it.
So what if you can't make it to a farmer's market, though?
You can have it grown for you by participating in a community-supported agriculture, CSA. Typically how this works is you purchase a subscription and the farmer delivers to you, or you can pick up a box or a bag of produce every single week. And it can vary in terms of quantity, types of fruit and vegetables, quality, etc. But it's a pretty good way to get fresh things in every single week. You can find one in your area by going to localharvest.org/CSA. localharvest.org/CSA.
And there's an there's another way to get the freshest fruits and vegetables possible.
Yes, this is if you want the experience that workers for hundreds of years have tried to avoid, you can pick your own by going to pickyourown.org, especially over the next 3 months is when most things get into bloom. But go to pickyourown.org, and that will show you a huge list. It's a great website because it looks like it was built in 1994 and then never updated for style, but definitely updated for information. Pickyourown.org gives you a ton of information, not only on where to find pick-your-own places in a particular area, but also the best uses in canning, et cetera, for all the things that you are going to harvest yourself.
Yeah, and sometimes you can go to those pick-your-own places and they've already picked them for you. So
yes, thank you. Here I go. Here's your money. And now I've saved a Saturday and my back.
Right. That's right. But, you know, I love farmers markets and, mm-hmm. and CSAs, but sometimes I bring home, you know, a car full of stuff, and then I can't finish it all. What you have tips too on getting the most out of it?
Yeah, other than Googling how to cook a 30-pound rutabaga, yes. That's the prepare in advance. Know what is in season. Go to the NRDC.org, the Natural Resource Defense Council. They have a complete listing of every single type of fruit and vegetable that's in season in a particular state, so you know what is in season. And then, like I said, get home quickly. And you may even want to bring a cooler with ice in it when you do go to the farmer's market or to pick your own, so that you can keep everything cool in the hot car and turn the air conditioning on as you're getting home. And then use it very quickly. Either make what you're going to make with it and freeze it, or do some canning on it and get that stuff put away, because most of that, if you don't act quickly, it ends up wasted. And finally, even though it might be organic, it might be locally grown by the best, most decent people in the world, you still need to wash all these fruits and vegetables thoroughly before you consume them.
And another way to get some good fruits and veggies is have good coworkers who have their own gardens.
Yeah, that can work in reverse. So we have some vandals in our neighborhood who drop zucchini on people's doorstep and say, "Here you go," and then usually it ends up across the street the next day.
The traveling zucchini. I think we should start that. That's funny. Well, if you have a question for Kevin, we will get to your phone calls now through the end of the hour. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Jordan in Madison is with us now. Hi, Jordan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So in about a month, I'm going to be a father for the first time.
Congrats.
And thank you. And so I'm just wondering if there's anything I should be doing in the first year to be smart financially.
I would panic first.
Okay, I got that one taken care of.
Good, check. All right. And then get as much sleep as you possibly can right now in the next month, Jordan, because if you're a good father, you probably won't get a whole lot for the next 2 years after that.
So I can save sleep like money.
Yeah, you can bank it, sure, and get interest on it. Right. Get a lot of sleep in August and then none in September. It all evens out. The couple things I would do, they're not fun things to do, but they're very necessary. Unlikely they will come into play, but it's still a good idea to do it. I would set up a will and guardians for this kid. Are you married to the mother, Jordan? Okay, that's a good step. Not perfectly necessary from my understanding, but it's a good start from a legal standpoint. But I would still have legal information set up so that, God forbid, something happens to either one of you or both of you, this beautiful baby is still going to be taken care of by someone whom you've chosen rather than having the courts decide it. I would also purchase term life insurance on the lives of both you and your wife. And I would like to have you have at least $500,000 of 25-year term life insurance on each one of you. You can go to termforsale.org or termforsale.com, excuse me, T-E-R-M, the number 4, and then sale.com, and we'll put that up at onyourmoney.com too. But the reason you want to have that is because you want it to be a complete waste of money, and you want to make sure that the child's taken care of both personally and financially, and the guardians do the personally, and the financially is taken care of by the life insurance. And after that, develop a budget, track your spending so that you know where all this money is going. You will be shocked at how the money starts going out the door for diapers, et cetera. It's terrifying, but people who've had children generally, not every day and not in every case, say they could never imagine not having that child.
All right, Jordan?
Yeah. thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. And
yeah, again, too late to turn back now, isn't it?
Congratulations and good luck. Gene in Onalaska is with us. Hello, Gene.
Hey, I'm calling in regards to I-bonds. I purchased them through a bank in 1993, and the maximum amount. And I'm wondering how long I should hang on to them and how to sell them if I need to.
Do you need the money right now?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
Okay. Then, again, I would definitely hang on to those. Because have you seen what the interest rate is on those?
I haven't really been following that close.
Okay. And it's very competitive for the time and place. Now, those weren't a great deal when you bought them. They turned out to be a phenomenal deal compared to what other safe kinds of investments pay right now. So I would definitely hang on to them. The bad news, Gene, is if you do need the money, and they will mature, if you will, in 30 years after the purchase and stop earning interest, not only do we have to pay taxes on them, but you have to submit them electronically through the website treasurydirect.gov, and that can be a pain to do. So make sure if you're not web savvy, you definitely want to find a family member or a friend who is, and tell them that if they help you cash them in, you might put them down as the beneficiary for the savings bonds.
When I bought these, there was a maximum per individual. Mm-hmm. Now there's down to, what, $5,000?
$10,000 per person per year. And you can get another up to $5,000 if you purchase it via a tax refund, meaning that you set up so that you get a tax refund, then you can have that tax refund directed automatically to purchase a particular bond. But you're right. These things are so good that they became too popular. And that's my conspiracy theory. Part of my DNA says that the reason the website is so hard to deal with is because they want to make these as unattractive to use as possible. But I still think it's worth the work.
Thanks for the call, Gene. Good luck. Tom in New Holstein is with us now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to speak to the grand wizard of personal finance and his trusty assistant.
Very good, Tom.
Thank you. I need some clarification. I turned 70 and a half next year. And how is the record keeping done on that RMD? For example, we'll be getting an annuity payment starting then. Well, it's actually started this year. And the annuity comes from an IRA. So what's the record keeping on RMDs?
For better or for worse, it's really only based on the balance of the accounts as of the previous December 31st. But have you already annuitized the account, Tom, meaning started taking the payments on it?
Yeah, this is one that was purchased for my wife's sleep factor about 10 years ago.
Okay.
And and so we have been taking it, and it will exceed quite a bit, I guess, by the 3.5% of my total IRAs.
Okay.
But I was curious about the record keeping.
Yeah, there's a balance, a cash value of the annuity that figures into that account, and the provider should be able to tell that how that figures into it. And you're right, usually an annuitization, especially if you've done it recently, will cover the RMD for that particular pot of money. But you still have to add up all of your retirement accounts, and you can take it all. Like, let's say your RMD from the total of your accounts were $5,000 for a particular year, but you're getting $6,000 from the annuity, and you're actually taking that money. It's being sent to you and taxed as income. That will qualify for it if it exceeds your RMD for all the accounts. But you do have to add up all of your retirement accounts to figure out how much is taken out. But the custodian and the provider of the immediate annuity can tell you the value of that in terms of figuring it as of the prior December 31st.
So is there a tax form or something to justify that thinking, or should I just document it if it's ever questioned?
It actually will come to you as they'll say, hey, this is a taxable distribution for you. And sometimes the IRS will call people on and say, hey, we vetted up our numbers. They don't make sense compared to your numbers. How did you get your numbers? And it's a fairly innocuous question. It's reasonable. And all they are is just asking. But yes, you'll say, well, this is the balance I used, and this is the dollar amount I took out. tell me if I was supposed to take out more or less. And again, because you're kind of, it sounds like you're exceeding the dollar amount, I don't think you should have a problem.
Good luck, Tom. Thanks for the call and the kudos. The false praise. Nina in Wausau is with us. Hello, Nina.
Hi. I have actually a follow-up question to the savings bond question a few minutes ago. My father, who is deceased, had savings bonds that I think he probably bought in the 1950s or 60s. They're in his name. There's about 15 of them. They're $100 savings bonds. I'm wondering about the process of getting those cash, and I would expect that it's probably putting them in someone else's name and then that person cashing them, and if so, what's the tax implications for that?
The tax implications are that if he didn't pay any taxes on the interest, whoever is lucky enough to get them is going to owe the taxes. It'll still be only a portion of the actual proceeds from the bond, but you will have to pay the taxes on it. Do you know, is it just his name on the bond, you know?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Most of what they had was in his name and my mother's name. She passed away first, so anything I could find, we tried to get in his name only, or with joint tenant with rights of survivorship. But he's recently found these things in, you know, just a box of stuff, like sometimes old people do.
Sure.
And so we're just wondering, what do we do with them?
Yeah. And do you know if there were a survivor named on the bond?
How would we know that?
It would be documented on the bond or some paperwork with it.
No, there's just these bonds. It looks like no one's ever touched them in an envelope. So I didn't see anything on there.
Okay.
I just saw his name.
What you want to do, Nina, is go to treasurydirect.gov, treasurydirect.gov, and we'll put a link up to that website at onyourmoney.com. And believe it or not, you will not be the first person with this problem, and you'll not be the first person of trying to settle an estate of an older person who purchased these savings bonds and put them in an out-of-the-way place. You're lucky you didn't, you know, have to find them behind the wall or something like that. So they will tell you exactly the process for not only submitting them, but also settling the estate and figuring out who gets it. And it will be a process. It will probably be worth it, but there will be a lot of paperwork and back and forth. But again, start at treasurydirect.gov.
Thanks very much, Nina. We did get an email from a listener challenging you, Kevin, on the date that you gave or the day that you gave for that upcoming financial literacy event.
Okay, I'm going to just double check it here. And it is Saturday, August 16th. If I misspoke, I apologize. But Saturday, August 16th is the date of the one in Madison. And again, if you want to find more about that event, go to assetbuilders.org.
And what's the website of the week?
Oh, the website of the week is one we've used before, but you should definitely check it now. DoNotCall.gov. The laws have been changed. They used to kick you off that every 2 years and make you re-register. But if you think you might have been kicked off or you've never registered or you have a new phone number, new cell phone or whatever, go to DoNotCall.gov to register your phone number. The good news is that should stop any commercial solicitations to you, but charities, nonprofits, etc., and as you're about to find out, political callers can still contact you without violating the law. But still, it's worth it to go to donotcall.gov, and we'll have that link up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Will do. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, will be back with us next week at this time for another edition of On Your Money. On Your Money is live every Tuesday morning at 8, repeated Tuesday evenings at 9, and repeated on Sunday mornings at 7. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Justin Williams for producing the program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.